It is just past 18 hours, 30 minutes and 28 seconds East African time. Time for John Sibi Okumu on Wednesday. This being Wednesday, the 7th of June, 2023. Hamjambo na karibuni. Hello and welcome. The first newspaper in Kenya, the East African Standard, was established in 1902, essentially to serve the European settler community. In 1919, an African-owned newspaper, the African Standard, was launched to cater to indigenous interests. It was later to become just the Standard. During the struggle for independence, print media played a crucial role in disseminating anti-colonial messages, promoting nationalist sentiments, and advocating political change in several local languages. The Daily Nation, which was to become an influential paper, was founded in 1960 with funding from the Aga Khan. Baraza and Taifa Leo, written in Kiswahili, also made an appearance at about that time. After independence, although successive governments have acknowledged the important role that newspapers could play in nation building, they have also introduced various laws and regulations aimed at control of the media. Press freedom per se has remained a historical challenge, with instances of censorship, harassment, intimidation, and indeed incarceration, particularly during periods of political unrest. For all that, journalism in our country has a very good reputation elsewhere. That is, relatively speaking. So much so that this is the question which we put to the people who graciously allowed us to invade their privacy for this edition. Do you think that Kenya has the greatest freedom of speech in Africa? Our mystery guest, who is undoubtedly among the cognoscenti on the subject of print journalism in Kenya, will have first comment on the answers given.
We are doing well in Uganda, but has been denied.
I do not know that. I'm not so well versed with the freedom of speech around other countries. Kenya has shown that it has a very good level of freedom of speech.
There was a lot of limitations, still other room for improvements, because they are still, we are among the best, but not the greatest.
In the past, we never had issues to do with someone criticizing the government of the day and just being left to be on their own.
We enjoy it more than any other country in Africa. To an extent, we misuse it.
So Kenyans, generally, we have platforms where we can receive information however we want, because they are not being coerced. The media is not sensitized. Show us whatever is happening.
If you understand, in our neighboring countries like Tanzania, Uganda, there's stuff they can't do, but in Kenya, you can do anything.
So Kenya has made its strides, but claiming it's the best might be getting ahead of ourselves. It's up for debate, and we need to keep pushing for progress and protecting freedom of speech across the entire continent.
Ndugu.
Yes, sir.
Comment, please.
I think those comments capture very well our situation. We do in Kenya today enjoy freedom of speech more than at any other time. Even if measured on a global level, I think we must be one of the freest societies in the world in terms of freedom of media, and beyond freedom of media, general freedoms of communication, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. We have to appreciate that we came from very bad times. Some of us were around in the days we used to say walls have ears. Those were the days when, even in the privacy of your home, with your own family, you were afraid to speak, because there was a monster called the special branch, which would somehow know what you said. It was almost as if they could sometimes read your mind. And before you know it, you are in jail for having seditious thoughts or for expressing seditious thoughts. Sometimes you have to go out of Kenya to realize what we enjoy. Go across the border, as one of our commentators said. Go to Uganda, Rwanda, Tanzania, Ethiopia, Sudan. They do not have anything approaching the kind of freedoms we have. Go to West Africa, North Africa. Maybe the only other country which can approximate those freedoms might be South Africa, I'm talking about the African continent. So we do have, we're also one of the few countries anywhere where freedom of the media is expressly protected by the constitution. In fact, I always point out that in Kenya, the media is the only industry that is singled out by the constitution for protection. Not brewing, not making cigarettes, not running a bar or running a taxi. None of those are protected by the constitution by name, only the media.
Right, Ndugu, thank you. Two responses, because you said the best in the world, so to speak. When I tune into channels in the UK or the US because of the language, the facility with language, and I see the Prime Minister might be addressed as Boris, maybe the President might be addressed as Joe, without any kind of fanfare as to who he was, or won't be addressed as former Prime Minister or the Right Honourable this and that. Doesn't that point to a kind of muzzling and kowtowing to the king?
Yes, it does. But it is.
And
not,
you've just said this is the best in the world.
That's saying it is not by legislation.
Right.
There is no law which says that I must address our president as His Excellency William Ruto.
Right.
I can, in my columns.
Yeah, but then you must have a fear. You must have a nascent fear that if you were to do so, Ndugu, things would get out of hand.
But that is what I do all the time.
You address them habitually as?
Simply Ruto. Read my columns in the Weekly Review. He is simply Ruto. Raila is simply Raila. Uhuru Kenyatta is simply Uhuru.
Right.
Maybe only in terms of the context of saying who I'm talking about, I will say the president at the beginning, at the first mention.
Right.
But after that, just by his name. Today in Kenya, you can call the president, and he knows it, and Zakayo.
Right.
Or any other not very kind one name we want to give him. And nothing happens to you.
I'm talking about the idea of freedom is that there are no limitations, the sort of limitations that Eliud Kipchoge has told us not to place upon ourselves. Another image from reading our papers from day to day, especially after the elections, is that the headlines on any given day habitually have this notion of confrontation with head-to-head sort of profiles, Ndugu versus Ndugu, Ndugu tells Ndugu to get lost, Ndugu planning to... The idea that the preoccupation is with politics alone on a daily basis over a five-year period, to me, Ndugu doesn't point to saying what you like. There must be other things we could talk about before the next elections, if we're truly free.
There are so many things we can talk about, but the point is that those things you are noticing are not established by law or by regulation.
So they're saying, you know, you're saying, it is you're saying in school you could smoke, but if you look carefully at the school rules, it says no smoking. Is that the image you're pointing?
I smoked in school,
yes.
but the rules say don't smoke.
Yeah.
But in this case, there are no laws or regulations determining what the media does or how you address the president.
Right, okay.
But sometimes, if there are restraints, it is within ourselves.
I was pointing to subject matter. What is this preoccupation with all things political at all times, forever and ever, till death do us part?
Maybe it depends on what you read. If you read Parents magazine, it doesn't have any politics. If you read Business Daily, very little politics. More of policy issues, the East African, and so many others. That preoccupation is with politics.
Yes,
is a preoccupation of the what you might call the mainstream mass circulation newspapers.
Right.
Not even the broadcast media so much, but the newspapers. And that might have historical origins, but it is not an established that way by any law. Maybe it is the market dynamics that tell you if you don't cover politics the way you've been covering it, you will have 90% returns. You will not sell.
Right. So it's a comment on Kenyans.
It is a comment on Kenyans and their preferences.
And therefore, we could perhaps philosophize about the preoccupation of Kenyans. They are not particularly interested in development or issues of societal change, they are interested in people's dopas being stolen and people organizing mass protest. So in other words, maybe we're fast forwarding and saying we don't have the maturity to address the topics that are of the essence to making a better society.
Our biggest problem is that our development is hinged on politics. Therefore, today the biggest debate is on the finance bill.
Yes.
And how the taxation issues. But also, if you go deeper, you might want to look at how it is proposed that money being distributed. Now, when you hear a politician saying that, no less than the deputy president, Rigathi Gachagua, saying that this is a government of shareholders, and the shareholders are the ones who will earn the benefits from government development projects or government employment or government jobs. Are you not going to react to that? We have in this country a history where entire regions have been ostracized or marginalized or shunned or denied what might be their rightful share of development resources, creating a very, very unequal society. Can we discuss or negotiate those issues without discussing the politics of it? Who is in charge of the kitty? Did we vote for the right persons?
But aren't you sort of shooting yourself in the foot by saying these are the issues to which journalists should be addressing themselves?
We cannot fail to address them if we want to resolve our existential problems. A very unequal society. It's supposed to be one of the most unequal society anywhere. Are we not going to look at how the kitty is divided and who is responsible for dividing it and who is responsible for putting in office those who are responsible for dividing it?
Good. I think we've made a good start, and this is going to be a hot debate, hot discussion. I think let's take a break for now, and I want to go back to the history and look at the history of what's come before, because we are looking at Kenya at 60. Thank you. Ndugu, let's look again elsewhere. Let's look outside Kenya. And we look at the Uzunguni and the idea that you can identify a paper and it represents some kind of affiliation. So Fox News versus CNN, The Times versus The Guardian and The Observer. We know that these are left-leaning versus right-leaning papers. And therefore, by choosing to buy one or the other, having it expresses my sentiments as a citizen. 60 years on, have we arrived at a similar level of choosing and picking based on ideology?
Sadly, far from it. Hmm. I have always advocated within the various forums in media circles, whether within the greater media discussion groups or within places I've worked, that ideally we should be able to, as a media or as individual media houses, take political positions in terms of ideology, in terms of endorsing certain policies or even certain political parties or political or candidates for office. Ideally, that is where we should be. But our politics has not matured to that level, because the moment you do that, then you will be accused of being partisan, of being in the pockets of this or that grouping. And that is in itself a reflection not just of our political immaturity, but a reflection of how our politics is played. Our politics is not based on any known ideology or policy programs or platforms.
So, sorry, I want the explanation to continue. What is it based on, Dugu? What is the German? Is it the sort of tyranny of numbers, sort of?
We can call it tyranny of numbers. And what is that? It is about tribe.
Right.
And rallying behind certain tribal chieftains and whatever, and even these groupings they form, you can call them, let's say, for instance, Kenya Kwanza, some conglomeration of so many parties, or Azimio, a conglomeration of so many parties. We call them coalitions. But they are basically a bringing together of ethnic groupings versus other ethnic groupings, and of course controlled by ethnic leaders. Today, all the parties which matter in Kenya are basically built around what you might call an ethnic leader, or a leader who can control his ethnic constituency. You can come up with the most brilliant policy platform, but unless you control your tribe and how it votes, you will never get anywhere, and nobody will listen to you. You will not even be able to wangle your way into some coalition, because what value do you bring? That is the sad reality. And then the sad reality is that today, if I am in a newspaper and I endorse, hypothetically, Raila Odinga, I will not be seen to be endorsing his ideology, what he stands for. I will be seen to be endorsing an ethnic formation. And therefore, I may boost my sales within that formation, or the population that makes that formation. But I will be shunned across the river, and I will not even be able to sell my newspapers there.
Right.
Remember, the advance that distribute our newspapers, Nation, Standard, used to be branded when they're traveling across the country, because they're all distributed by road. Today, they're not branded. Why? Because in some areas, the population will be hostile to them.
Right. Another image that I brought up in my introduction is this whole idea of ownership. Again, look at the sort of Western model. You have Rupert Murdoch and whatever he owns, and one rich man with owning many, many titles. But here we mentioned the Aga Khan and the Nation, I mentioned rather. But everybody sort of sitting around a coffee table or having ugali and sukuma wiki knows that that papers are owned by various, again, political chieftains. We know that the Standard Group, supposedly, is the baby of the Moy family from that particular era. So if they are, I would assume, waiting for a great political comeback, isn't that going against this idea of the political freedom of speech that we sang so highly of it to begin with? It's my newspaper. That you're telling me it's you can say what you like in my newspaper when I want you to say certain things. Terrible question. When we've had newsrooms raided, you know, by the First Lady and papers sort of burnt up in the middle of the night.
We have a free media, and there is no bar against anybody launching or buying into a media house. Even in the West, whether it is the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Times of London or Fox News, they're owned by conglomerates or individuals who may have a certain agenda or a certain leaning. No difference here. If you look at all the major newspaper groups, they're owned by somebody. You mentioned the Aga Khan. And that one is a bit unique because it is owned by what you might call a foreign, largely foreign, although it is quoted on the stock exchange, it is owned by a largely foreign grouping. That used to be the same issue with the Standard until the Moy family and until Lonro Group divested and the Moy family bought it. But even if you look at Royal Media, it is identified with SK Macharia. If you look at Radio Africa, it is identified with Patrick Kwaku. But within Radio Africa Group, you have the Star newspaper, which, although it is identified by Patrick Kwaku, it was known that Evans Kidero, who went on to become governor of Nairobi, had a major
stake.
And even here where we are seated, Capital FM, before it was identified with MACTO and the Londro conglomerate, after that it was identified with Chris Kirubi, who might have had his political leanings or affiliations, and they could be reflected in the editorial output, as the same way they may be reflected in Citizen TV or Daily Nation or The Standard or anywhere else. Those are the realities.
So what is your, what do you think as a veteran journalist is your obligation to Wanjiku, this great rallying character, Wanjiku, the person in the chamber? How are they ever going to get close to the truth when the truth which I'm expressing is my truth as a very rich man with huge political ambition?
It's a dilemma we have to live with, because Wanjiku unfortunately does not own a newspaper and does not have the resources to own, to even buy into one. But we who sit on the editorial desk, I think, must recognize that beyond commercial considerations, beyond whatever political affiliations we may owe loyalties to, we must recognize that the media is not just any enterprise. It is not a bakery, it is not a bar, it is not a shamba. It is an institution that is globally recognized as the fourth estate. That recognition I talked about, granted in the Constitution, calls for a certain responsibility. We must recognize that our responsibility is to our nation. Our responsibility is to Wanjiku. We have often said that we are the watchdog of society, and we have a duty, a sacred duty, to live up to that responsibility.
I go back, Ndugu, to the daily headlines in the major. There's no watchdog. The headlines are verbatim on any given topic. Should we say the same across the board? Everybody's saying the same thing. I'm reading the wrong newspapers daily.
Let me
daily.
Tell you, maybe you're reading the wrong newspaper. Let me put it this way.
Yes.
If the topic on everyone's mind today is the finance bill, and specifically the proposed housing fund, I'll call it a levy, a tax, a saving, whatever you want to call it, how do we get out of that?
We have
a responsibility to address it. But then we should address it beyond what Ruto may be saying, or Raila may be saying, or whatever other any other political formation may be saying, and pay much more attention to helping Wanjiku understand that finance bill in its totality, and then she may be able to make her own decision on is it good or bad. Which means we must also remove ourselves from the political spin being spun by the various formations.
Right. Again, I beg to differ in the sense that our rallying call here is that we have amongst the greatest freedoms of speech in the world, and it's guaranteed in the Constitution. But I am saying that maybe there is somebody to blame who's letting the side down, and maybe we could have a segment on that. And that is the whole notion of editorial policy. Who's calling the shots as to what is it? Is it you, the columnist? Is it you, the revered columnist, who's telling me what to think on an issue? Do you know what I'm saying? Is that a personal question?
I, as a columnist,
yes.
Nobody tells me what I write, what to write, and how to write it, and what topic to cover. I make my completely independent decisions, and they are not dictated by the editorial, by the editor, or the editorial policies of the newspaper I may be writing for. But then also we recognize that different newspapers have their own independent editorial policies. Now, ideally, that independence should be safeguarded within the newsroom, within the editorial suite, so to speak, that there should not be pressure from the owners or commercial considerations or external pressures from politicians or religious groupings or any other forces that we used to call it the divide between church and state, that within this newsroom, the church is the editorial floor and it is insulated from the state, which is the administrative, the finance, the commercial side, and you know, it should, in theory, that's the way it should be. And I think at one time it used to be that way. But today, of course, we're seeing a lot of breaching of that wall.
Okay. It's 18 hours, 58 minutes and 12 seconds, close to 7 o'clock and close to a break. Ndugu, if you'd permit me to go back one, I didn't stick to my own rules. I wanted to look at the history for our young listeners. The presumption is that our listeners are predominantly young. And I would like to think of something for you, like the post-election violence of 2007. So all hell has broken loose in the country. The results are being challenged. The country is about to, you know, go up in flames. People are jetting in, all kinds of envoys from Africa, from Europe, to try and create a sort of rapprochement, peace. And I remember very vividly that there was a point where all the papers came together to write either the same headline or the same, they came together for a national purpose. Was that the only instance when such a coalition was required in our history?
I don't recall any other instances where that kind of thing happened.
But it seems to have set a precedent. In other words, you were for development, you were for bridging the gap between the rich and the poor. And it seems to me, because again in the introduction, in pre-colonial times, there was the press as an agent for anti-colonial sentiment, as I expressed it. What is the press doing now? What's the great campaign, apart from staving off starvation in northern Kenya?
Before I respond to that, I'd just like to go back to something, which is a continuation of again, where I was before you made your closing remarks at the last segment. And I mentioned that the editorial suite should be free of even the commercial section. There should be a Chinese wall between the two. And that includes, I don't know whether Capital FM has an editorial policy. If it does have an editorial policy, then it should be in sync with the Code of Conduct for the Practice of Journalism in Kenya, which is an part of the Media Council Act. It is the regulations under the Media Council Act, the Code of Conduct for the Practice of Journalism in Kenya. And it says very clearly, editorial should be completely separate from advertising, and every advert should be signposted as an advert. What that means is if in the East African Standard, for instance, there is an ad placed by Kenya Breweries or Safaricom or Kenyatta University or KBC or Barclays Bank, it should be clear that it is an advert and not part of editorial. And if by its layout they look alike, then it will be clearly signposted advertisers' announcement
I understand.
Or sponsored content.
Right.
Now, the moment an anchor or a producer or a presenter on radio or TV uses his same space, the same voice, to read an advert for KBC,
as
or anybody
just done.
Else,
right?
That is a breach of the Code of Conduct for the Practice of Journalism in Kenya,
and
it is wrong, and it never used to happen until maybe 10 years ago when it started becoming
the norm,
and now everybody does it. Nation FM does it, Nation TV, Capital F, Capital Citizen, Radio Africa, they're all doing it. But it is still in breach of those guidelines.
Right.
So we
but this, it ties into this idea of generating... My layman's understanding is that people need money to do things.
Yes.
And maybe what I've just done is what pleases the person who's keeping the station alive. And if it's government, let's look at the word government. If you fall on the wrong side of government, then they will withdraw all their advertising for tenders and whatever. And recently, let's go back in time to the idea of the press can be muzzled simply by cutting off all funding.
Yes, that is a big threat to press freedom. But the moment we acquiesce or succumb, then we are part of the problem and not part of the solution. We have had instances where big corporates have denied certain media groups advertising because they're not getting favorable coverage.
Yes.
Or the government is denying advertising because they don't like the editorial policies of a certain newspaper. We should be able to challenge that and to fight it and to resist. The moment we lie down on our backs, then we are betraying the calling.
But Ndugu,
it is a reality.
You're seeing it sort of that we should put it in our military fatigues and go out, you know, the journalists should. But let's go back to 60 years on, we're looking back. And again, the word on the street is that the media in general is suffering. Production houses are laying off staff or unable to pay them. So what are you going to blame that on? The corporates? COVID-19, what's happening here?
Let me put it this way.
Mm-hmm.
I will not blame COVID-19. I will not blame withdrawal of government advertising. In fact, I've always told my colleagues that the formation of that so-called government advertising agency and is a blessing in disguise, because it makes us realize that we must not be hostage to any one big advertiser. Then we must appreciate that the media landscape is changing, that readership and viewership patterns are changing. Some of us grew up buying newspapers on our way to primary school. Today, even people in university don't buy newspapers. Okay? Things have changed. The onus is on us to find out how have they changed? How do we need to re-engineer ourselves so that we can still thrive in that changing environment? What can we do?
What makes you necessary? Why do you make essential? Because if something becomes obsolete, then maybe it's like the dinosaur. It's seen its time. Tyrannosaurus
today
Rex.
Today we are all moving towards the digital platforms.
Yes.
Okay. Mm. The main sources of news today are websites and even social media. What we have not managed to do is to learn how to monetize that content. We are still looking, doing it the same way as selling space in the newspapers or selling a segment on radio. And yet the young people today are not watching newspapers. They're not even watching news on TV or listening to news on the radio. They're happy with the sound bites they can get on TikTok, WhatsApp, Twitter, and all those other platforms. Instagram, we are all playing in that space.
So the print,
but we have not learned how to monetize it.
The print media is a dying beast. If you say that, then that'll be very sad for me, because we have to end the conversation.
It is not dying.
Yeah,
but I think we can look at success stories elsewhere. Look at things like the Washington Post. At one time, they laid off virtually most of their staff because they wanted to go online. Along the way, they realized that even online content must be produced by journalists. It can, the everything else can be automated, but not the intellectual capital, not the intellectual resources. They retained the Washington Post, but went very big online. They actually hired more people than they had fired, because online version has to be, it's not a daily newspaper. It has to be updated virtually every minute, 24 hours, day and night. People don't put the paper and go to bed. So there must be enough people to turn it to keep that 24-hour news cycle. Those are the realities. We have not managed to adjust ourselves to that.
But yeah, I must take advantage of your being in the studio,
yeah,
because it seems to me, listening to myself speak and you speak, is that we're being very current. Kenya at 60. Would you like to go beyond my hodgepodge introduction and give us what to you have been landmark milestones along the way in the history of print journalism in independent Kenya? Something that I may have left out that, again, maybe the young are unaware of. That's why I pointed to this idea of 2007 and the role of the press in mitigating violence.
Let me start with 2007. And I think that was the first time I've ever seen all the newspapers, all the media groups come together and issue what you might call a joint statement or a joint editorial. And I think that was a recognition that Kenya is on the brink, that we might have no country tomorrow if we don't take a very bold step today. I am proud to have been part of the discussion leading to that, let me call it an accord or a concord. And it was very much driven by the editors-in-chief of all the newspapers. Of course, the owners came in, or the people who, you know, the CEOs, if not the owners, and all agreed that it must be done. What I do know is that even at other periods of national crisis, there has been some quiet consultation on one editor. The editor-in-chief at Nation can call the editor-in-chief of Standard and Royal Media, and they sit down and say, things are critical. How can we handle this responsibly? Sometimes there will be agreement. Sometimes there will not be agreement. Okay. That was one instance because Kenya was on the brink. Kenya has not been faced that situation again. And I don't think there has been any time since then when there has been such a common platform. If anything, it is more of rivalries all the time and trying to beat each other to the news. Let us now go back to pre-independence. You mentioned in your intro the role played by what you might call the nationalist press in the struggle for independence. Jomo Kenyatta had his Muigwithania, a Kikuyu language newspaper. Harry Thuku had a newspaper. Jaramogi Odinga and Ochieng Oneko had the newspapers. Bildad Kagai. Kagia had a newspaper, so did Paul Ngei. All those papers were formed for a purpose, to push the struggle for independence. Okay? And then we got independence and settled down to a very conservative approach to things. The big newspapers, which were foreign-owned, the Nation and the Standard, were both conservative, although they had different histories. And by the way, a correction: the Nation, yes, was launched in 1960, but it was preceded by Taifa, which had been launched in 1958 by Charles Hayes. Charles Hayes was then bought out by the Aga Khan in 1959, who then launched the English language Daily Nation in 1960. And that paper was launched specifically to counter the Standard, because the Standard, which initially was formed by an Indian immigrant called Jivanji, I think, then was bought out by the settler establishment, was basically pro-settler, anti-independence. The nation was launched in 1960, or rather even if you go back to 1959 with the Taifa, to be the voice of the Africans, okay? To be the voice of the majority. But after independence, they each settled down into some very conservative approach, which meant basically supporting the government.
A one-party press.
Of the day. Yeah, one-party press, you could call it that. Mm. And until when we came to the struggle for multi-partyism, if you go back to 1989, 1990, and then you had Society Magazine of Pius Nyamora, Nairobi Law Monthly of Getobu Imanyara, Finance Magazine of Njahoga Tabaki, and others. They pushed the boundaries. They took up the struggle for democracy at a time when nation and standard were very hesitant, could barely just feel a little bit and step back. They took on that without fear.
I'm going to stop there for a short break, and then I'm going to urge you to explain the significance of the weekly review.
Okay.
Ndugu, the weekly review, Tailoring Weno. What did they do for us?
The weekly review was formed in 1975, I think, by Tailoring Weno. And it immediately stood out as a very bold weekly news magazine modeled on Newsweek. What made it stand out was not that it was radical. It was not particularly radical.
Analytical.
But it was very political, and it provided depth and analysis which the daily newspapers of the day would dare not touch. The reporting then was limited to he said, she said. The minister said this, the president said this or did this. That was the template for the nation and the standard at that time. The weekly review came out with analysis, with interpretative journalism, and made itself the authority on political developments in Kenya.
Okay, fast forward, because this is our last segment. So we've got to move faster to get in a few more paragraphs. What happened after these sort of halcyon days of the weekly review and analysis, so that it's being suddenly revived as a online mechanism 40 years later?
Okay, for, the weekly review folded, I think, in late 1990s or early 2000s, around the same time a spin-off called The Economic Review also folded. What happened is that by that time, the daily newspapers had also gone into analysis. They had also upped their game. In fact, they had taken much of the stuff from the Weekly Review and other such publications. And also it happened that the big corporates were not interested in advertising within what you might call a niche low circulation product. So all the advertising revenue was going to the mass circulation dailies. Now, you're aware that last year the Weekly Review was relaunched as an online public, first as an insert within the Sunday Nation.
Exactly.
And then an online publication. Nation Group bought the Weekly Review title from Hilary Ngweno, I think, more than 10 or 15 years ago, but could never quite decide what to do with it. And the various conversations, I'm told, went on and on and on. And last
now
year...
Now we have the manifestation.
Last year, those conversations were revived. And they decided to relaunch the weekly review. And they even brought in some of the fellows who used to write the weekly review. And on the one hand, the reception has been, I would probably think it has been very good. On the other hand, I think it may be appealing to a generation which read the weekly review
all those years back.
And that generation is dying out.
Nostalgia.
So there is need to look at what can we do for the generation of today.
Right. Ndugu, before you reveal yourself, I seem to think as a Kenyan citizen that once again, post-August 2022, we seem to be headed for an agenda of confrontation. Let's have strikes every Monday and Thursday. We must talk, and if we don't talk this way... you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, of course.
Can the press, is this yet another moment after 2007 where the press, we came back circling this topic by you saying you can write whatever you want. So why, for example, or maybe you have, why don't you write that it doesn't serve to go around breaking buildings up and destroying bridges and dams and everything. The destruction calls for anything. Why isn't that the headline on a daily basis for the young people to read?
I would say because we need to celebrate our freedoms.
Celebrate our freedom?
We need to celebrate the right.
Okay.
To demonstrate. We need to celebrate the right for Mandamano, to make noise, even if you have nothing to say.
But my key word was violence.
Yes, I am coming to that.
Blow your house down, the three little pigs.
But we must also draw the line.
Yes, sorry.
Between demonstrations that are unruly, that result in violence, that the organizers seem to either want violence or unable to contain their own people. We have written about it. We have written against that time and time again, even as we have written against the tendency of the police to go around bashing people's heads just because they're exercising their rights to demonstrate. If you read our newspapers, you will not miss that.
Okay, so the press is doing the most it can do to be the watchdog of society, and society is running its own course. In other words, it's powerless against certain developments. It's a watchdog that can't bite you.
The press plays a major agenda-setting role.
Well, in all the speeches that Ndugu, in all the speeches that everyone gives, if you listen to Joe Biden and all these American presidents, they're always saying the press is the last bastion of sanity in any society. If freedom of press is not guaranteed. And we're going back to your initial statement. If this is the country with the greatest freedom of the press in the world, then why isn't Kenya an earthly paradise? Do you see the linkage between the two? You're saying this is wonderful.
We have the freedom to write, to broadcast, and all that.
Yes,
but we can only hope that those who need to listen are listening. We can't force them. We can hope that when we write about the police bashing people's heads, that the police are listening. When we write against people breaking, turning what should be peaceful protests into violent orgies, we hope that the participants are listening, and we hope that their leaders are listening. You know, but in between, there are so many other things. We're having a very vibrant discussion today about the finance bill, and all the information people are getting, whether pro or against, comes from the Kenyan media, not even the foreign media, the Kenyan media. Anytime President Ruto wants to reach the people, he speaks through the Kenyan media. Anytime Raila Odinga, the opposition leader, wants to reach the people, he speaks through the Kenyan media. And every time our people need to know what is happening in the country and what their leaders are saying, what their representatives are saying, they tune into the Kenyan media. As simple as that. There are places where there is no media to listen to or to depend on. I've been places in Africa, where West Africa, Burkina Faso, or other places, something very, very major is happening. And everybody has to try and tune in to AFP or some French broadcaster to find out what is happening in their own country. Even the president sometimes wants to address his own people and has to use a foreign radio station to reach his own people. So let us celebrate some of these things. We are not ideal. The press is not ideal. But the freedoms we have, let us celebrate them. Let us protect them.
Ndugu, mystery over. Could you reveal who you are?
My name is Macharia Gaitho. I am an independent journalist. I, of course, I'm affiliated with the Daily Nation, for which I write a weekly column and also provide occasional political analysis. I'm part of the team, of course, that relaunched the Weekly Review as a Daily Nation product late last year. I've been around, done that in the Kenyan media context. I call myself an untrained journalist.
Right. Well, if revelation were to be in order, when we all write our memoirs, we have to remember that we both went to the same high school, which we won't reveal in this context because we're not into publicity making, and that you are my junior. So I, given to the rituals of the time, I should be able to present my shoes for you to polish and my books for you to carry to school. So we have to establish that. How did you decide? Why did you become a journalist? In terms of talking to the young, not personalize it, what was the attraction and the allure? And why do you still have faith in it as a mode of existence?
I studied design. I attended the University of Nairobi, where I got a BA in design, graphic design.
Yes.
But
that's because you were called to that's the degree you were offered.
I always had an interest in journalism. And I would say my interest in journalism started almost from childhood. When I was in primary school, I would save some of my bus fare. We used to go to school by bus, so that I could buy a newspaper at least every Friday.
Right.
In fact, I remember even teachers coming to borrow my newspaper.
So you had a fascination with language.
Language, with news, with current events, with what's happening.
And therefore you could urge that read a lot? Because everybody, if you don't read,
I read newspapers every day. And I did not just read the news of today. It means that I also read backwards.
Yes.
That I knew what happened at Independence, even though I was not there. I knew about the killing of Tom Mboya in 1969, the launch of KPU and the detention of Oginga Odinga in 1966, even though I was not there, because I took time to study, to read backwards, to find out that what is happening today has a genesis in what happened yesterday. It distresses me today to sit in a newsroom, tell a journalist to write about a certain event, and he says he was too young or he was not yet born. So let us study.
Yes.
Let us keep abreast of current events. And it does not have to be politics. If your passion is music,
yes,
then learn music.
What did you do to learn language as a Kenyan born in a village somewhere?
Well,
most of us are.
I went to a good school.
Yes.
And I grew up in a very cosmopolitan environment, growing up from nursery school, where English, not Kiswahili or Kikuyu or Kijaluo or Kalenjin, was almost the lingua franca.
Mm.
We were Kenyans, we were Africans, but from all communities.
Yes.
But somehow English became the lingua franca. And in any case, the language of instruction was English from primary school. The language of instruction in secondary school was English. The language of instruction in university was English, and it still is up to today. So nobody has an excuse to be incompetent in English. After all, you're doing your exams in English, whether it is exams in science, in biology, in mathematics, you're doing that in English.
Ndugu, I won't oblige you to clean my shoes. It's 19 hours, 29 minutes and 42 seconds just passed, and sadly time to stop. Do continue to give us feedback, hopefully positive and reassuring, on the Twitter handle @CapitalFMKenya, or drop us a text or WhatsApp message on 0701 984 984. I've been talking to Masharia Gaitho, a veteran journalist, although in his own words, untrained. And you've been listening to John Sibio Kumu on Wednesday. Thank you very much for doing so. Most kindly, as usual. Very much obliged. Till next time.